You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 1st of June 2017 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Andrew Muller. On today's show,
Russia is fake news. This is fake news put out by the media.
And back in Russia, Vladimir Putin appears to agree, or does he? My guests Samira Shackle and Phil Clark will be here to discuss that and the day's other big stories, including Russia's pledge to maintain the Paris Climate Change Accord even if the United States won't, the possibility that the next president of the US might be the previous vice president, and
we invited the leaders of seven parties to take part. Some are here, others chose to send senior representatives.
Has anyone seen the Prime Minister? That's all coming up on Midori House on Monocle 24 right now. So, welcome to Midori House. My guests today are Samira Shackle, freelance journalist for Deutsche Welle, Al Jazeera and Monocle, among others, and Phil Clark, reader in comparative and international politics at SOAS, University of London. Welcome both. And we will start tonight with Russia's President Vladimir Putin and his ongoing campaign to refute the stereotype that the people he leads have no sense of humour. Speaking to journalists in St. Petersburg, Mr. Putin stuck to his previous denials of Russian state involvement in tampering with last year's American presidential election, but allowed that it just might be possible that what he described as patriotically minded Russian citizens had acted on their own initiative. Samira, he went on to say that hackers are like artists who just whimsically choose their targets in accordance with their deeper feelings. He just laughs himself to sleep every night, doesn't he, Vladimir Putin?
Yeah, he has a lot of fun with kind of changing his story, often with these funny turns of phrase, isn't he? I thought it was quite reminiscent of his story he had over Crimea. It was sort of, no, the Russian state's got no involvement at all. We've got nothing to do with these Russians who just happened to be fighting there. And then later sort of like, hey, of course we were totally involved with that.
Or were we?
Yeah, exactly. You just get the sense he quite enjoys it.
But that's quite an astute parallel, isn't it, Phil? We are seeing a pattern here. Agents which may or may not be in the employ of the Russian state doing things either in physical landscapes or in cyberspace just to kind of screw with people in a sort of semi-deniable way, and Russia says it's not really us, but everyone knows it really is really. Do they actually have an end game or end result in mind, or is the chaos the actual end in itself?
I think the chaos is the end. I think this is exactly what Putin wanted. I think he wanted Trump in the White House, which was just a completely unpredictable event. I think he wanted all of this innuendo and uncertainty around Russia's involvement in the election. All of these Senate inquiries and other investigations are absolute catnip to Putin. So he's absolutely got what he wanted out of this. In terms of this, you know, today's story, it seems to me he's conceded that these investigations are going to show very systematic Russian involvement in it. I think he realizes that that has to come out of these inquiries. So he may as well get ahead of the story and say, well, look, it wasn't Russian state involvement. It was, you know, a whole range of everyday citizens from Russia who were doing this. So I think it's, you know, his attempt to try and control the information that is undoubtedly going to come out of these investigations over the next couple of weeks.
It is infuriating, though, isn't it, Samira, that this approach works? It's like you said, in Ukraine, they were Russian soldiers who spoke Russian, driving Russian tanks equipped with Russian kit, and yet Russia's official response was like, no, it's nothing to do with us at all. I mean, is that going to work forever?
I think that a big part of it kind of, and you see it perhaps to a slightly lesser extent with Trump and the White House, this kind of a tactic of denying things which are palpably, obviously true, is it sort of serves to devalue the truth itself, which I think is a big part of the aim. So you have Putin over the course of many years, very in Russia domestically and now internationally, sort of very deliberately trying to undermine the very nature of what's true and sort of just cast enough doubt around, sling enough mud at your opponents, cast enough doubt, and who's to really know if your critics are telling the truth or not. And you see it in Russia, it's caused sort of wide-scale apathy amongst the electorate. People sort of, well, what's really true or not? Who's really to know? And you see Trump very deliberately employing the same strategy when every time he's criticised by the media, he just says, no, that's not true, even if it's literally things that he's recorded saying or has like written down. You have his White House press secretary, Sean Spicer, sort of wheeled out to deny things which have been broadcast on television, all of this stuff. It's the same kind of thing, devaluing truth and sort of questioning the very nature of what's true and who owns definitive fact.
It is 2+2=5 territory, isn't it? Putin, Phil, did also today, and this may, I guess, tie into what you were saying, he raised the possibility that somebody else was creating a false trail of evidence that would implicate Russia. He's getting his preemptive defence in there, isn't he?
I think so. And that's interesting in and of itself, because it suggests that Putin thinks that it would somehow be damaging to Russia if it showed that the state was directly involved in the hacking of the Democratic Committee, which is kind of interesting to me in and of itself, because my sort of default position would have been he doesn't care about this.
What's what I say? Would it be damaging? It certainly wouldn't be damaging to him politically in Russia, would it? Couldn't he just go out and stay in front of his people and say, yeah, I screwed with the American presidential election just because I could?
Indeed. I think his actions today suggest actually he is worried about it. So that the task here is to try and fathom why on earth he would be worried. And I think it, you know, one sort of hypothetical would be that he does think that this would, you know, close down some of his ability to act as a diplomat on the international stage, that, you know, other powerful leaders, including within the Security Council, are going to treat him with even more, you know, distaste and suspicion than they do at the moment. I think it's interesting that he does think this is a potential problem. If you'd asked me this yesterday, I would have said, no, he's not going to care what comes out of these Senate inquiries. He thinks that the job was already done. He seems more worried about this than I would have thought.
Well, let's move along slightly, although sticking with Russia, it does appear that we may shortly witness a rare schism between Moscow and Agent Trump. The US president, still struggling to distinguish between reality and reality television, has declared that he will reveal his decision about keeping his country's commitment to the Paris Accord on climate change in the White House's Rose Garden today, although it remains unclear to whom the rose will be presented if Trump wishes to withdraw from the agreement as anticipated. Russia, however, has reaffirmed its support for the deal. Samira, in reaffirming its support for the Paris Accord, is it Russia sending Trump a coded instruction here?
I don't know. I mean, it's interesting that, Putin, with this, as we were just discussing, has been inconsistent on a number of topics, to say the least, and climate change is one as well. So it wasn't absolutely clear that they were going to continue with their commitment. He's sort of spoken about the risks of climate change, I think, recently has sounded a slightly more sceptical note again. So it's reassuring, I think. Perhaps shows that, it's not Russia and America aren't going to suddenly magically start doing absolutely everything in accordance with each other on the world stage. And I thought it was interesting that the Kremlin spokesman pointed out the fact that mentioning Trump or the US specifically, saying that it's obviously going to be much harder to agree the goals without key partners being involved, which it obviously will. It's interesting.
Phil, would Russia see this as a victory? By which I guess I'm asking, do they see any indication of American withdrawal from international bodies and international agreements as a victory?
Absolutely. I think that's one of Putin's key strategies. And I think it's one of the reasons he backed Trump so heavily, was hoping that the US would become increasingly insular, increasingly detached. It would create a space at the international level that Russia could very quickly fill. But I think there's a couple of other things going on in this issue around the climate change agreement. One is that in many ways, this also shows that the Paris Agreement is barely worth the paper that it's written on. It's extremely lax in what it actually requires states to do. So it doesn't really cost Russia anything to say we're going to, you know, maintain our ratification of this. I think the other thing it shows is that to a certain extent, Russia does have some major concerns about climate change in its own backyard. It's losing the North Pole by the day. It has big problems with parts of Siberia literally melting into the sea. So for all of Putin's bluster and you know, sort of very obvious skepticism about climate change, and he's been very skeptical about it, I think a lot of others around him are worried about the impact of climate change on Russia itself. So I think that's explaining part of what's going on here.
Samira, as Phil points out, Russia is in a position where it's likely to feel the sharp end of climate change, or rather the extremely soggy, damp, cold end of climate change faster and worse than a lot of other countries. But where on the spectrum do you get the sense that Russia's investment is in the Paris Accords between, you know, absolutely determined sincerity and willingness to adhere to the limits and the principles, or do they just see this as yet another mechanism for beating up on their opponents and advancing their own interests?
It's quite tricky because I think they've got sort of kind of contesting interests in it, because they're obviously a big producer of fossil fuels. So there's that, which is quite a strong motivating factor not to take it too seriously. If a big part of your economy, which in the economy sort of famously been struggling quite a lot, if a big part of that depends on the continued marketability of fossil fuels, you know, that's not going to encourage you to take imminent action to reduce use of said fossil fuels. But I think also, you know, as Phil says, that they are kind of at the front line of the places that are going to be affected by this. So I think it's somewhere in the middle. But also, I think these kind of big international agreements become not just about the thing itself. So this isn't really just about climate change. It is for everyone involved, I think, about positioning and moral leadership and authority on the world stage. And you see that not just in Russia's positioning today, but also China has been, they're doing this kind of unprecedented statement with the EU about climate change and sort of urging the US tacitly to stay on board. And that's, again, partly about climate change, but I think also partly about saying, look, we're working together and sort of making signals about sort of positioning and leadership internationally.
China does actually seem to be taking this fairly seriously, Phil, after many years of trying to avoid taking climate change seriously as they embarked on their industrialization poverty eradication program. But I think they've realized that they now actually have to take it seriously. But of course, if Trump does announce today, as anticipated, that the US will be withdrawing from the pact, that doesn't actually kill it, does it? The entire rest of the world can still get on with it.
Yes, and a sign of that is that tonight there's supposed to be a very unusual European Union and China joint statement, sort of, you know, reavowing their dedication to the Paris Agreement. So you get a sense that China is very much on the front foot about this, that the European Union is as well, and the two of those powers together would be enough to carry this, I think. I mean, I think Samira's point about moral leadership is absolutely key here, and I think that does matter to Putin. In some ways, it goes back to the first issue about Russia and the hacking case is, you know, Putin, for all of his freewheeling and unpredictable ways, doesn't want to be a complete pariah, doesn't want to lose a powerful voice on the international stage. And we've seen this in Syria with Russia's sort of re-engagement militarily there. This all fits, I think, with Putin's desire to re-engage Russia as a major international power. And so things like the Paris Agreement on climate change will also play into that.
But this is the great weirdness of what we're witnessing, isn't it, Samira? Not just with this particular Paris Accord, but I think Trump inadvertently, as he does so many things, is demonstrating the extent to which the world has come to rely on America to provide the moral leadership you mentioned, but the actual leadership in so many respects as well, since the end of World War II, and certainly since the end of World War II, arguably before that. Are we now witnessing, you know, the rest of the world, especially the big powers, all looking at each other thinking, well, who's going to do it if they're not?
Yeah, perhaps, I think. Maybe not with such apprehension. I think probably on the part of China and Russia, there's some hand-rubbing about that, I think. Probably quite pleased. I think, it's kind of this turning inwards, which lots of people predicted might come out of the Trump presidency, does seem to be coming to pass. This sort of America first idea and isolationism, etc., etc. There's lots of people around Trump who are real proponents of this kind of economic nationalism, that who I think will see this, if he does, as is expected, withdraw from the agreement today, I think we'll see that as a victory for the kind of positioning that they want, which is saying, well, screw the international community, that's not what we're interested in doing, we care about America and American jobs, and that matters much more than the international community and all of that. So it's kind of it's a sort of different kind of positioning that's much more geared towards Trump's supporter base, I think, who are just more worried about their jobs and don't really care about rising ocean levels and a faraway part of the world. It's kind of short-sightedness, obviously, but I think sort of quite deliberate rejection of that internationalism that's dominated America for so many years.
I mean, are we learning, Phil, and this appears at least to be the bet Trump is making, and given that, you know, he did manage to get himself elected president, his judgment of these things must be conceded to count for something. Are we learning that for a great many Americans, their pride in the United States and what it stands for is not at all tied in to its superpower role? They don't really care at all whether America projects itself in the world or not.
It was one of the most surprising elements of Trump's presidential campaign was this very clear statement that it would be America first and he would be pulling the US off the international stage. I was surprised by how vehemently he pushed that. And it wasn't just in terms of military engagement, which would be quite obvious. It was also a reduced role in the UN and the Security Council, decreasing funding for UN agencies. It was a general sort of shrinking back into the domestic sphere, which did seem to play extremely well with his base. There was a sense of perhaps our government has left us behind by spending too long sort of, you know, trying to meddle in other countries' affairs. It's time to look after our own backyard. That does seem to have played extremely well. And I think that's exactly what Trump is trying to tap into with this imminent withdrawal from the climate change agreement.
Okay, we're going to take a short break now. You are listening to Midori House here with me, Andrew Muller, along with Samira Shackle and Phil Clark. Coming up next, if it's not too early to be talking about candidates in the next US presidential election, is it too late to be talking about Joe Biden?
Monocle's dedicated network of international bureau and correspondents bring the best global stories to our readers and listeners. Our eagle-eyed team of editors and journalists staffing bureau in Toronto, New York, Zurich, Singapore, Hong Kong, and Tokyo deliver the best content from the world's most important regions straight to the airwaves of Monocle 24 and the pages of Monocle magazine. We've also got boots on the ground in more than 30 cities worldwide thanks to our comprehensive correspondent network. It's for this reason Monocle brings an up-to-date, informed and engaging commentary from Brasilia to Brussels and from Sydney to Singapore. Monocle, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
You're back with Midori House on Monocle 24 with me, Andrew Muller. Still with me are Samira Shackle and Phil Clark. Now, the Democratic Party in the US may spend the rest of its life trying to figure out how they managed to lose the 2016 presidential election to not merely the least qualified candidate in American history, but the least qualified citizen of the Republic, with the arguable exception of Charles Manson. One of the uncountable what-ifs, which has been deployed as solace or retribution or both, is the one surrounding former Vice President Joe Biden, who declined to run in 2016 following the death of his son Beau from cancer the year before. But Joe Biden is today launching a new political action committee, seen by some as a suggestion that he does fancy a crack at it after all. Samira, the obvious point first in terms of Joe Biden, no disputing his, you know, reputation or his CV, etc., etc., etc. In 2020, he will be 77 years old.
Yeah, it's quite old, isn't it?
He would be the oldest by 7 years, first president, I think, sworn in for the first time.
It's pretty old.
Is it too old?
Yeah, I mean, it is quite old. I mean, if you think about the fact that it's a four-year term and people often end up serving two terms, and they're talking about being well into your 80s at the end of a second term or indeed going into a second presidential race, it's definitely old. It's sort of loath to say if it's necessarily too old or not, but it is hard to imagine someone sort of being able to keep up the energy required for potentially two terms of presidency. But then again, you know, I think we've had various sort of older politicians standing for elections here in the US, and as sort of populations age, perhaps it's inevitable that people will, you know, you're not kind of going into decades of retirement necessarily, but yeah, it's a question mark. And if he does decide to run, it's definitely something that will come up a lot, I think.
Leaving aside the question of his age, Phil, would it look like, from the Democratic Party's point of view, you know, popular and likable though Biden obviously is, would this be the Democratic Party effectively admitting, yeah, we've had 4 years to think about it and we haven't come up with any better ideas?
I think it would be partly that, and partly in the wake of the madness of the Trump presidency, let's go back to someone absolutely safe and stable. I was going to use strong and stable there, but I think that's probably the wrong phrase in the current circumstances. But I mean, I think that's one of the questions that comes out of the Trump presidency is from the Democrats' point of view, how do you respond to this? I mean, who do you put up to try and reassure the public that government can function and that, you know, a sense of sanity and sensibility can come back into the scheme of things? And maybe in that regard, Biden and his age and experience actually looks like an asset rather than an impediment. And I think certainly that is his reputation. It seems right across the board. I think he was largely quite a popular vice president. Even as the brickbats were being sort of hurled at Obama, that Biden seemed to remain in the background and seemed quite sort of impervious to much of that. He seems to have no baggage. That's what's quite remarkable about him, given how long he's been on the scene, that he seems to have no controversy. There seems to be no innuendo around him. And so that, I think, is going to look an absolute premium, given what we've had to deal with in the last 6 months and may have to deal with Trump all the way up to 2020.
I mean, Samira, if heaven help us, Donald Trump is running for re-election in 2020. How should the Democrats play that? Should they regard it, as they clearly did last year, as an open goal to get pretty much anybody they liked over the line? Or should they do the thing that Phil is suggesting, just think, let's just try and find the safest pair of hands in every respect we can possibly find? Let's find a dull white guy in a suit and stand him up against Trump.
It's quite difficult to say, I think, because it was so unpredictable last time. I think also that will depend quite a lot on how the next few years play out, and you know, if the last sort of 6 months are anything to go by, there'll be pretty hefty amount of ammunition from Trump's own record to throw at him. But you know, that his popularity has been plunging, as far as I'm aware, since he took the presidency, and sort of where those popularity ratings are at, I think, will probably really affect how the Democratic Party play it at the next election. I think it's a bit of a challenge, though, because the idea of you know, he's unpredictable, he's effectively useless and a complete political novice, let's counter that with a safe pair of hands, is what they were supposed to be doing with Hillary Clinton in the election.
So.
And, you know, fair enough, she's got these unusually low personality ratings, she's got a lot of baggage in the sort of public arena, but that palpably didn't work, and it was a kind of anti-establishment vote to an extent. So whether fighting that kind of anti-establishment campaign will be closed off to Trump after 4 years of being the establishment or not, that sort of remains to be seen. But it didn't work last time, so don't know.
Just a final thought on this one, Phil. The pointless counterfactual hypothetical. Would Biden have beaten Trump had he run last year?
I think he would have had a really good chance, if only because I think he was more methodical and less complacent than Hillary. I think he would have crunched the numbers and realized where the swing states were, and he would have concentrated on that. The idea of Biden running reminds me a lot of John Kerry running against George W. Bush. There's a kind of a similar dynamic there. Here's this, you know, complete maverick, all of these epithets about Bush is not that smart, he's being controlled by the people around him. Let's put someone, you know, safe and stable in the form of Kerry there. I guess what we found out about Kerry was actually he did have a lot more baggage than anybody thought, and that was used against him very effectively. Possibly it's the same with Biden.
Okay, well, finally tonight, here in the UK, we have 7 more days left of the least inspiring general election campaign since the last one. Last night, the leaders of all the parties, aside from the one presently running the country, appeared in a televised debate. The Prime Minister, Theresa May, claimed to have better things to do with her evening, but was gifting her opponents 90 minutes of airtime to spend criticising her for not showing up a wise move. Samira, there is, of course, everyone I think is familiar with the common wisdom about debates. If you are the actual incumbent, if you are ahead in the polls, if you can possibly avoid the debates, avoid them, because you can only lose. Was not showing up actually a smart move for her?
I think when she first said, when she announced the election, that she wasn't going to take part in any television debates, it was really, really easy to see why she was saying that. As you say, there's no discernible benefit for her at that point. You know, she's got sky-high popularity ratings. Jeremy Corbyn's ratings are incredibly low. If they go head-to-head, there's absolutely no way she can live up to this kind of idealised view of her that's been presented, that sort of, you know, she can only really come down from those very, very strong popularity ratings. Corbyn, there's only really gain for him because he can't possibly live up quite to the to the level of demonization. Yeah, he's going to obviously not going to be a sort of evil overlord when it comes down to it. It's just going to be a guy. So it would be only gain for him and only loss for her, really. So you can see why tactically she would decide not to. But in the event, I think yesterday was quite a different kettle of fish to the leaders debate that happened previously. So the one that happened previously, Theresa May didn't go, Jeremy Corbyn didn't go. So we had the kind of slightly odd spectacle of a group of MPs who...
It was like the Eurovision semi-finals.
Yeah, it was very odd. I mean, I think collectively all those parties get, you know, they're going to get 14% of the UK votes. It's quite an odd thing. And I think had Corbyn gone to that, it would have been quite marginal. But yesterday was slightly different because there were representatives of all the parties there. Corbyn was there, Amber Rudd was there in lieu of Theresa May. And she did just look quite weak, I think. And no one missed an opportunity to lambast her for it. And in those closing statements, everyone's making their pitch to the public. It's quite hard for Amber Rudd to repeat that strong and stable leadership line when the leader hasn't shown up, which is quite a clear display of weakness. So I can't imagine Theresa May watching the debates at home felt, oh, that was a really good decision on my part.
It has been a weird campaign in that respect, Phil, because the Conservatives clearly decided very early on to make it all about Theresa May. In fact, for in the first few weeks, the word Conservative was barely mentioned. It was Theresa May and the Conservatives very much further down the bill. But it does, you do get the impression, when you compare her and Corbyn, that you are watching two people doing a thing. One of the people involved really doesn't enjoy doing this and therefore isn't any good at it. And the other one, it's the one thing we know about Corbyn. This is the thing he enjoys doing. And it turns out he is actually doing pretty well at it.
It's very odd. You're absolutely right. For the first couple of weeks, the Tories wanted only Theresa May on the front pages, on the television screens.
They were strong, trying to stable.
They were trying to hide all the crazies like Boris and, you know, David Davis and all the rest of it. But suddenly now you can't see May anywhere. They're having to hide her because she's been shown to be a complete liability at these things. Anytime she has been involved in a debate, as she was on Monday night, even on her own terms, she came across, I think, as extremely weak and uncertain. She's the cause of this massive U-turn on social care, a key plank of the Tory manifesto. So this is kind of crumbling in front of her eyes. I mean, I think what is very peculiar about all of this, of course, is that she called an election that nobody wanted. And this is what made her sort of absence from last night's debate particularly spectacular. I mean, you know, it's like, I mean, the only sort of analogy I could come up with was, you know, this is someone who has invited everybody to a terrible party that nobody wants to go to. Everybody begrudgingly turns up and then the host is not there. And so everybody's left thinking, why on earth are we doing
the
this?
The trouble is when you phrase it like that, it sounds like a pretty cool move.
She had better things to do.
I quite like the idea of inviting loads of people you can't stand to a party and then just say, no, screw it, I'm going out.
And they're taking a bottle of Jack and going home to the living room, which is what I assume she was doing last night. So I think given that she called the election and we were only having these debates because of her and nobody else, it made it very peculiar that she wasn't there last night. It's doubly peculiar, of course, too, because her party's ratings are plummeting. If the Tories were way out in front and everybody was absolutely certain that they were going to win the landslide that May thought they were going to win, then you could understand her not turning up last night. But in a time of real vulnerability, and Corbyn and the Labour Party, I think, making very serious gains. We'll find out next week exactly how serious they are. I think the Prime Minister needed to be there last night. She looked extremely weak for her absence.
I mean, her poll lead in most polls is still pretty handy. Most people would be delighted to have it at this point in an election campaign 7 days out. But Samira, are you buying the Labour surge? Do you think it's a thing?
I think it is.
But bear in mind that, you know, Ed Miliband was drafting his victory speech on election night 2 years ago.
But that, I mean, the thing is, I think that the surge is real. I don't think that will necessarily translate into a victory because there's two different kind of poll results here. There's the fact that Labour as a party have really surged in the polls, and that is remarkable, I think. Even on sort of averages of different polls, they've gone from lagging behind by an average of about 50 points when the election was called to about 4 points now, and that's not outlier polls, that's sort of averages of different polls, which is the most reliable way to do it. So that's absolutely remarkable. But I think when people are voting, sort of various different, I think studies have shown and academics have said and so on, that what's actually really important is competency and views of the leader, and that remains really poor. That's kind of the weakest link. People might support Labour's policies, might think they're saying good stuff, but ultimately Corbyn's personal ratings and the question of competency are poor.
Samira Shackle and Phil Clark, that is all we have time for. Thank you both for joining us. Today's edition of Midori House was produced by Ben Ryland, researched by Gaia Lutz and Christian Radev. Our studio manager was Kieran Banerjee. Music next at 1900 Monocle's editor Andrew Tuck is in with The Urbanist, and I'll be back with more on the day's main stories on The Daily at 2200. Midori House returns at the same time tomorrow, 1800 London. For now, I'm Andrew Muller. Thanks for listening.